Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. Right now, we are going to go to Brussels. He is not only a foreign minister for Ukraine, but from a family of public service to Ukraine. His father was ambassador, including a long tour of duty to Kazakhstan. Maria Tadeo with Mr. Kuleba in Brussels. Maria, good morning.
Yes, Tom, good morning. And we're now joined by Dmytro Kuleba, who, of course, is Ukraine's foreign minister. And when this war started, you, alongside the rest of the Ukrainian government, you made the decision of we're not going to leave. We're going to fight for our country and we're going to win this war. I wonder, now you've been on almost a global tour. You've met pretty much with everyone that can support your cause. What is the message that you're sending diplomats when you go on this tour?
You did not believe in Ukraine. But now you can see that Ukraine will win this war. Stand by us and share the victory with us for the sake of the world. Because this is not only Russia's war against Ukraine. This is the threat that Russia and the challenge that Russia poses to the entire world. We have to stop them here in order for others not to suffer as much as we do.
And one of the things that you say and President Zelensky repeats too is that when you look at the strategic options right now, the only strategic option that works for Ukraine is winning, is a victory. Nothing else will suffice. You say we got to win. What does it mean in real terms?
Well, you have to understand that this is the war for our existence because President Putin does not recognize our identity. He does not recognize the right of Ukrainian state to exist. This is why we understand that we have no other choice but to win this war because it's a war for our existence. And winning it means first deoccupying our territories, restoring territorial integrity of Ukraine within its internationally recognized borders. We have no intention to capture anyone's piece of land, even an inch of it. But we want everything that belongs to us to be ours.
And of course, you often hear, I know this really makes you angry and infuriates Ukrainians when you hear things like, oh, but they should just accept a ceasefire or perhaps just give away the Donbass and this will put an end to it. What is the flaw in that theory, according to you?
One of the reasons why this war is happening is because since 2014, some Western countries...
What countries? You say some Western countries. Which one? You mean Germany?
Germany, France, to some extent the United States and other European countries. They were always pursuing the policy of half measures towards Russia.
Because they're scared of Putin?
Well, you know, every country is special. Every country has its own reasons to pursue one policy or another. But one of the reasons why this war is happening, it's because everyone was always telling us, Ukraine, you have to concede on this to pacify Putin. You have to concede on that to prevent the war from happening. Now, this war happened. It means only one thing, that this entire policy Ukraine has to concede on something failed. Doesn't work this way. So instead of asking what Ukraine should do for a ceasefire, for the end of the war, the question should be addressed to Russia, what Russia should do. And I would like to commend now both Germany, France, the United States for really changing their perspective on this. We still have some discussions, but in principle, they clearly understand that this is a black and white situation, and it's Russia who bears full responsibility for what is happening.
And Mr. Kuleba, you mentioned the French, and I have to ask you about this, because over the past 48 hours, there's been a huge debate as to whether or not Emmanuel Macron perhaps suggested to Mr. Zelensky that he should give away some land in order to get a peace deal. Then, of course, the French denied this. What's going on here? Has anyone ever told you, and when I say anyone, of course, I mean global leaders, just give away Crimea, give away something in the east? Have you been pressured to do that?
I was not present in the conversation that my president referred to, in the conversation with President Macron, so I cannot comment on this. But before 2014, before 24th of February this year, when the war started, yes, there was some, they were not pushing, but they were kind of exploring the option of what could be the solution, what could Ukraine abandon in order to make a deal with Russia. But I want to make it clear, and I think it's everyone who is watching news from Ukraine and sees Russian soldiers committing atrocities, Russian army destroying our cities, it's not Ukraine to blame. This is an unprovoked war. Neither Ukraine, nor Europe, nor NATO, nor the United States provoked Putin to do what he is doing. And therefore, he must bear full responsibility for that. And looking for face-saving options for Putin is a simply false approach. Let Putin himself find a face-saving option for him.
And sir, I have to ask you, of course, about NATO. Over the weekend, we had Finland, Sweden applying for this. We've heard a lot of people saying, yeah, we welcome them. I'm guessing for you it's a bitter moment because you tried that path to, and you didn't get the welcome you were expecting. I hope, or I wonder, are you disappointed? Are you sad by that? And when it comes to the European Union, which we have here in the background, I mean, is this your best hope now? Is it the EU? You've given up on NATO.
I believe Ukraine is the best hope of the European Union, because look how the European Union changed in the last 2.5 months. In the beginning of the war, the perception was that NATO is strong and NATO can act and NATO can deliver. And the only thing EU can do is to express different levels of concern in public statements. And the war proved that everything is completely different. It's NATO that, as alliance, as an institution, can do very little, if anything. Mm. Allies, yes, they are very helpful. The coalition of the willing who represent part of the alliance, they are very helpful. We will never forget how they support us. But NATO as an alliance did nothing. EU sanctions, strong political statements, economic support, financing military support to Ukraine. European Union is back on track as a driving force, mm-hmm. as someone who shapes the future, who can shape the future of Europe. And it's Ukraine who gave them the chance to demonstrate that they can.
And you make that very clear. Mr. Kuleba, thank you very much. I know you're heading to The Hague tomorrow also too. I know you told me you want to pursue this case of criminal charges against Russia and the Russian army. Thank you so much for your time, and we appreciate it at such an important hour for your country.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you.
Jonathan?
Maria, thank you. A wonderful interview with the Ukrainian foreign minister.
Now, to get out front of a sacred oath, Mark Esper, you know him as a Secretary of Defense of modest controversy for President Trump, but far more, the most coveted award at West Point. There is a statue at West Point, and far more, the heritage is seen in the Thayer Hotel of one Douglas MacArthur. And when you win the leadership award at West Point in honor of General MacArthur, it's a big deal. One of those winners, Mark Esper, joins us. Winner maybe doesn't do it justice. Mark, tell me about What General MacArthur would do today, with all of his controversy within the Republican Party, the middle 20th century, isolationism and that, what would General MacArthur do with this modern Defense Department that we have?
Well, it's a great question, and I guess thank you up front for the introduction, Tom. You know, MacArthur, what we would consider him today to be a combatant commander, right, because of his command in the Pacific and later during the Korean War. But, you know, for West Point, West Pointers and others in the military were most recall his famous saying about duty, honor, and country. And that is the West Point motto. And he says, those three hallowed words reverently dictate what you ought to be, what you can be, and what you will be. And it was that phrase and that saying, as it goes, is what in some ways guided me during my tenure, both as Secretary of the Army and Secretary of Defense.
I am fascinated by your thoughts of the, and this is a very sophisticated word, sir. I don't know if you saw this at West Point, the ginormous NATO exercises going on right now from Estonia and Lithuania on down. This is a new world we are in. Is our Defense Department ready with Secretary Austin for this new world?
We are getting ready. I think a hallmark of the Trump administration was we advanced a national defense strategy that I made number one, my top priority to implement. But this defense strategy also described a new era of great power competition defined as China as our top strategic adversary and secondly as Russia. And to confront these two countries, particularly China, we really need to modernize the military from the equipment to our training to our doctrine. And all those things are underway. So it's important that the Pentagon continue on with what we developed during my tenure and that we also provide the funding. That's really, you can't do it without having funding. And I've been disappointed by the White House's, the Biden administration's funding requests these first two times. They've been flat. And thankfully, the Congress increased the spending. And that's going to be critical to driving change and modernizing the armed forces.
Secretary Esper, based on what we've seen with Russia's invasion of Ukraine, how should the U.S. military view what to expect with Xi Jinping and Taiwan, especially as he does seek yet another term?
Yeah, look, it's the great question. Russia, we always define as a superpower, but a declining power. And it's been evident from their actions the last 90 days in Ukraine that they're not quite the power that we thought they were in terms of military capability. So this has been a strategic failure across the board for Russia. But China is very different, right? It's an economy of $16 trillion, second largest in the world, 10 times bigger than Russia. Economic interdependencies that run around the world. We're seeing just because of the shutdowns due to COVID in Shanghai and other places, how the supply lines reach. So we need to be very careful about how we plan and prepare to deal with China. We need to send the same and the proper signals of resolve and determination to defend young democracies or democracies like Taiwan and make sure they understand that we're going to defend this world order, these sets of norms and values that have really helped promote prosperity and freedom around the world for the last 75 years.
Secretary Esper, the Trump administration was known for looking inward, to being very nationalistic in the approach to geopolitical concerns. And we're at a moment where NATO seems to be coalescing in order to deal with Russia and the invasion in Ukraine. How much should the U.S. military and beyond sort of build on this coalescing of NATO and work with allies in order to get some sort of bigger presence, whether it's in Asia or at least to figure out how to respond if there is an invasion of Taiwan?
Yeah, look, we absolutely have to. I consider myself a Reagan Republican. Ronald Reagan promoted American strength, peace through strength. He believed in the defense of democracies and the world order as we understand it and believed that we should stand up for our friends and allies. And I made an important plank of my tenure to really go out there and try and strengthen our allies and grow new partners. And I'm a big believer in NATO, and having served in NATO as a young Army infantry officer, I believe that we need to continue to do this. And I'm glad to see finally that NATO is coming together. More countries are willing to commit more for defense, and that we have possibly, hopefully, two new countries joining. And, you know, ironically, it's Vladimir Putin who brought the alliance together. So the key thing will be sustaining this momentum as we at some point look eastward toward China.
Mark Esper, the nation was fractured off of Vietnam, Republicans fractured, Democrats fractured. It was equal opportunity. But we're still adjusting. And now, as Robert Gates would say from our holiday from history, we're still adjusting to the debris of Vietnam. Are we adjusting in real time? And how do Republicans and Democrats come together to help those with a sacred oath?
You know, you're right. I mean, after the Vietnam War, it took the Army 12, 15 years when I entered active duty in 1986 to really rebuild under, again, President Reagan. And I think now we're coming off the wars the last 20 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. And again, during our time, 2018 and beyond, we began rebuilding the Army and all the services. So it will take time and money. But look, I've said on many occasions here the last couple months or so that the greatest threat I see facing our country is the extreme partisanship on both sides of the aisle that is creating dysfunction in Washington, D.C. And then until we solve that problem, it's going to be hard to challenge to take on the big issues such as, you know, our growing budget debt. It's what, $30 trillion? How do we come up with a consensus that with regard to a strategy toward China? How do we address all these big issues facing our country? And that's going to be key going forward.
Well, going forward is what we wanted to accomplish here. Mark Esper with an important book. For those of you on radio, you just need to know there's a certain weight to it, like 600-plus pages. Mark Esper, A Sacred Oath. Really can't say enough. And, of course, he leads front and center with a gentleman that he worked for at the White House.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new. To build something better. To know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Long ago and far away, before the advent of financial media, there was actually an understanding that bonds were not just full faith and credit, or FF&C. The financial media only quotes full faith and credit. Thank you, Lisa Abramowitz, who's made a career of looking at credit and high yield. So, too, Amanda Lynam joining us, global credit strategist at Goldman Sachs right now. In the old days, you had a blue book, a Standard & Poor's blue book, and you thumbed through it, and you looked at corporate bonds. And to say Dan Fuss, the giant at Luma Sales, has said, you can enjoy losing money at corporate bonds. How much are we losing right now with the aggregate index down 10% plus?
Yeah, good morning, Tom. Thanks for having me. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how both IG and high yield total returns were off to their worst start on record. So it's been a very, very painful year. I think the key risk for bond investors, in our view, is that that's been entirely driven almost by the rates component. And spreads have held in very well. So in the event that we do get a recession, which is not our economist base case, but if we did get get one. There's a lot more room for spreads to widen and kind of even exacerbate those losses that we've already recorded year to date. And so that is one of the key risks to the market.
What are IG investment grade, old style bonds? I want to buy a General Motors bond. It's a part of the aggregate index. What do you do where equity people say, I'm going to go to cash? Or, you know, I think there's a dialogue about what equity people do. What do bond people do when they, quote unquote, want to go to cash?
Yeah, they often move up in quality or shorten duration. But one of the risks that we've highlighted in our recent research is that actually moving too far up the quality spectrum in IG also has its risks, because those are the companies that are likely to move ahead with, say, debt-funded M&A or aggressive shareholder returns, irrespective of the slowing economy. And so we actually like within IG that sweet spot of triple B rated firms. Those are companies that we believe are committed to staying investment grade, but are likely going to behave in a more conservative fashion relative to, say, their highly rated peers, cash rich pharma and tech companies, for example, that will do M&A regardless of the backdrop.
Amanda, where are we in terms of what we're pricing into the credit market right now? Initially, you talk about the worst start of the year ever. That was largely due to rates. That was not due to the extra cushion of yield that accounts for potential defaults. Now we're shifting into something else where you're starting to see that widen out. How far in that process are we?
That's right. So we have not priced in a lot of default risk, and specifically kind of zooming in on the high yield market. And we do think that that's probably appropriate at this stage. So just to set the backdrop, our economists are not expecting a recession as their base case this year. And what we've said is that even if we do have a downturn and growth slows substantially, the high yield market is unlikely to experience the uptick in defaults that we're kind of used to seeing in previous cycles. There are a few reasons for that. One is just we didn't have a default cycle that long ago, right? So in 2020, we had a lot of the weaker firms cleaned out of the high yield market. Energy and metals and mining and kind of natural resources are also in a much better position now relative to previous cycles. And those are historically the vulnerable sectors. And then also we have a lot of cash on hand and balance sheets are very strong. So to answer your question specifically, we're not baking in a lot of default risk in the high yield market right now, based on current spreads of 450, but that's probably not inappropriate given the I would say the higher quality and the increased strength of the high yield market moving.
Amanda,
forward.
A lot of people would agree with you, and we see this note after note. Basically, even if we get a recession, things don't have to get that bad in credit because people have pushed out their maturities so far because there was this washout. What does that mean in terms of how high the Fed can go with the Fed funds rate before we have a real problem in credit, which is really the market that the Fed watches and potentially would respond to, not equities having a bad day?
Right, exactly. So our economists expect a terminal value of 3 to 3.25%. A large amount of that is already reflected in Fed fund futures, for example, and baked into the market. I think there's a lot of room to go for financial conditions to tighten and really for the Fed to deliver on the hikes that are already priced in to the market. And I think credit investors are expecting that. Really, the key risk for credit is if we had a freezing up of the primary market activity such that corporates, if they wanted to access the debt markets, could not. Right now, we're actually saying that a lot of the muted supply volumes are due to an unwillingness to access the market on the side of corporates, as opposed to an inability. And it goes back to exactly what you mentioned. Corporates have the luxury of being patient. They spent most of 2020 and 2021 raising cash, pre-funding years in advance. And so they're not really at the whim of the market in terms of having to execute in a choppy conditions. I know Jonathan talked about this on Friday afternoon on his program, but really on those windows of stability, you're seeing a lot of activity. And we think that's indicative of a market that's still remaining open, but yet much more challenging in terms of timing that appropriately.
You have no idea how jealous TK will be. Tom's going to be so jealous that Real Yield got the plug there. Amanda, thank you.
Right now, let's move on with this economic analysis of the United States to a more global sense. Off of the Milken Institute meetings, William Lee joins us, their chief economist. Bill Lee, can the markets constrain or restrict the Fed? If we look at the Bloomberg Financial Conditions Index, it's sort of doing its job right now, making financial conditions more restrictive. How will the Fed react to that?
Well, right now, the markets are doing 110% of the Fed's job because the market increases are way above where, as John just said, actual increases, but also the expectations of that aggressive policy stance is something that the markets are clearly priced in. And I think it's based on some misguided information. My colleague, former colleague Andrew, is an example of that, where he's focused on the aggregate wage price numbers. And I've been looking at the micro wage price numbers, and I really don't see massive signs of a wage price spiral as 1970s style. In fact, most of the wage increases have been going to where the labor shortages are appearing, the low wage workers, the younger tenured workers.
Billy, you're world famous for this, and it goes into a decile analysis, I would guess. Economists like Citigroup love to aggregate numbers together. What part of that decile analysis matters for Chairman Powell in the view forward?
Well, Chairman Powell absolutely cares about the aggregate number. But do you see aggregate wage price spiral? Now, granted, the Fed has lost credibility since its meetings. The average inflation rate break-evens that are priced into five-year securities is way above 3.5%. But given that, I think we shouldn't get too carried away with how much the Fed has to tighten. Don't forget, the Fed, for the first time in Fed history, we have two policy tools, the balance sheet and rates. And I think one of the strategies that they haven't talked about enough is using that balance sheet to cool off and target those red-hot sectors in real estate and consumer durables by draining the liquidity from there, especially the mortgage backs, and by then easing up on the amount of rate increases they'll need. That this is, again, the first time in history of the Fed with two policy instruments, it may be able to escape crashing the economy to bring inflation down to its target level.
Bill, some of that in the market ended in a bit of a mess in 2018 when they tried to wind down the balance sheet. They're doing this at a much more aggressive level, twice the speed, once they get going. Bill, can you just add a little bit more color to that? How much they're about to do with the balance sheet and how this is going to work through the economy, through financial conditions?
This is one of the great uncharted territory because the Fed has really never done balance sheet before. And as you said, the last time it did it in a very clumsy way. Right now, it has to be very careful in using that mortgage-backed securities holdings because that is where the real red-hot sector is, the real estate market. And draining liquidity there is going to be absolutely critical. But now the Treasury runoff is something that will be done on almost autopilot because it has maturity holdings that are so short. But I think the key to the Fed's policy stance is how aggressive does it have to be with rates on top of that. If you really believe that there's a wage price spiral being priced in, then it has to be aggressive, no doubt. But my view of the numbers on the labor market is such that, you know, if you're above the median wage or median profile of the median worker, you're not getting the 10, 12% wage increases. You're getting barely 2 and 3% for senior managers. So I think the Fed has to cool off a bit in terms of worrying so much about that wage price spiral. There really is no sign of it yet taking hold. And I think that's something that Wall Street has missed entirely.
Even so, if the Fed is targeting inflation, even if it's not coming from the wage price spiral, there are so many inflationary pressures coming from China, from the supply chain disruptions, which are not necessarily positive for growth, which are not necessarily signs of momentum. But still, the Fed has shown a willingness to target demand in order to respond to supply side responses. What's your view on how far they would have to go to normalize the supply and demand side of the equations?
Well, that's the lesson learned from the 70s. You cannot let prices get out of control. Even though a lot of the inflation is coming from the supply side, the Fed's job is to equilibrate supply and demand. If you can't get supply up, then you certainly have to bring demand down. And the wrong way to do it, though, is through hit targeting investment, which is the cost of capital. Right now, I think the key to inflation in the future is productivity-enhancing investment. That has to be encouraged. And I think the Fed, to choke that off just for the sake of hitting its 2% target in a reasonable amount of time, would be a serious mistake because that would cost us in the 3 to 5 year horizon in boosting inflation without those productivity enhancing investments.
Right now, we've got a 2-year Treasury yield at about 2.5%. The team over at Bank of America, which we'll catch up with John in a little bit here, believe that it will go up to 3.5%. Do you think that would be enough to torpedo this economy, to actually send the United States into recession?
It would be enough if we drain liquidity adequately from the red hot sectors using the balance sheet. It will not be enough by traditional measures. And so I think that this, as I said, has got to be a time when the Fed can no longer say the balance sheet is the passive tool and the secondary tool. It has to become the primary tool for cooling the economy. And as far as China's concerned, by the way, the real key to watch is whether or not China becomes aggressive and takes over more aggressive about Taiwan. Because the lesson learned from Ukraine that shocked the leaders over there is that the world came together and became much more cohesive. That will put a stopper, I think, on military incursions into Taiwan, but it won't stop their cyber attacks or political strategies. So there the supply constraint is a real issue because TSMC is global. There is no substitute for advanced chips. We can find other places to buy wheat. We can find other places to grow corn, but we cannot find another TSMC.
But just quickly, within the Communist Party, do you think that the leader, President Xi, is in a position where he can make a step as bold as the one that you just described?
Right now, if he gets his third term, the one thing on Xi's mind is that he will leave the legacy that he created the path of returning Taiwan to China. This is something no one has accomplished. Deng Xiaoping, no one, not even Zhou Enlai or Mao Zedong. So this has been a China obsession for decades, ever since China opened. So you betcha he's going to be going after Taiwan. The question is how. And right now, the world coming together about Ukraine, I think, has put a stopper on any overt military actions.
Bill, wonderful to hear from you, sir. As always, Bill Leather of the Milken Institute.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stiefel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stiefel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stiefel.com. That's Stiefel.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Let's kick off the program today with Christian Nolting, the Chief Investment Officer at Deutsche Bank Private Bank. Christian, six straight weeks of declines in the equity market in America. Christian, when do you buy this? When do you make a move?
Yeah, fortunately, we have been underweight equities, and honestly, we are now thinking also of coming back at least to going to a neutral position because we are seeing bearish signs in the market. There's probably no change to zero COVID policy. There's still supply chain issues, so everything is super bearish if you look bull bear index. So I think it's time to go back a little bit to neutral, but very important, it doesn't mean that we are now getting super optimistic, right? The environment is certainly a tough one, to be very honest.
Christian, Ben Laidler's out with a note this morning where he basically says a lot of companies didn't get the crisis memo. And you see that with the great separation, which I'm sure you see as well. How does profit matter going forward?
Yeah, if you look at the markets and you analyze the market movement of, for example, the S&P or here in Europe, I think what's very interesting in the recent weeks, also including this last 6 weeks, you've seen that very, very high correlation of indices to real rates. I think that's important. There's the inflation component. It has not been so much about the results of the companies. I think that might change down the road. For example, if you have the Q2 earnings season coming in then in July, I think, of course, there will be a lot of focus on how much margin pressure was there or is still there because of inflation. So I think there's a change. But if you look recently at markets, this was certainly driven by inflation and real rates for that.
So Christian, you are underweight equities, but you are starting to get a little bit more constructive, even as you see the prospect for recession continuing to climb over the next 12 months. Can you parse through how you can be bullish on equities heading into a recession?
No, I'm not saying I'm bullish on equities, but I'm saying we have been underweight equities, which was certainly right call. And you have, even in bear markets, even recessionary markets, we have one of the strongest rallies sometimes in markets. And I think if sentiment is so negative, there is some room, even in a recessionary environment, for some market upside you don't want to miss. But it's not that I'm saying you get overly optimistic, you do know massive overweight in equities. I think that's not the economic environment we are in.
And Christian, it sounds like you want to go back to neutral. So let's talk about that. Where would you buy to achieve that?
Well, markets which are mostly underweight was the US, was also China, for example, and there's a lot of discussion, of course, on China. I don't see immediate change. Look at the results or the numbers we've seen this morning in China. I've done called colleagues in China. The sentiment is extremely bearish. No change to zero COVID policy. But if you look longer term, right, the market is down more than 35% since the peak. I think if you at least go to a more neutral position, that cannot be wrong. If you buy something 35% lower, not overweight, but go to neutral, I think that's the direction we want to go.
Christian, wonderful catch up, sir. As always, Christian Nolting of Deutsche Bank, Private Bank.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.